Welcome back to Upzoned after a week off, the show where every week we take just one big story from the week in the news that touches the Strong Tones conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I am back with Chuck after, you know, not really a long time no see. We were away in Asheville together for all weekend, the entire weekends, and now we are finally settled back in to our respective homesteads. How are things up in Minnesota?
Great. I know you are aware of this, but we got someone tweeted us that we have too much banter at the beginning of upzoning because the episode where it was actually my birthday and you were like wishing me a happy birthday is like, get to the point. And
no one cares. Yeah,
and I'm like, that's about as brief as two Midwesterners, you know, that's about as brief and impolite as two Midwesterners can be.
Y'all are lucky that I'm not asking about every single person in his family. I'll just say that you will take this and like it. Well, let's keep the banter short then and get right to the point. I have an article to talk about today that coincidentally both of us put in our social media channels this week, and I was like, and so did Daniel. And I thought, you know, there's something to this one. It touches on a topic that we get questions about a lot at Strong Tones, which is this question of code enforcement. You guys at Strong Tones talk all the time about how our cities are falling into decline and da 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 da. But what, you know, what's the role of the city just getting landlords to shut up and do their job, fix the windows, cut the weeds, all these things? Shouldn't all these stuff be kind of fixed by enforcement? And there was an article that came up on Fast Company that had a very innovative approach to this. It is taking place in Mobile, Alabama. And maybe, you know, just in the interest of getting another voice on here, Chuck, you could tell me a little bit about what that approach was and why it spoke to you, because it seems like you were as interested in it as I was.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think as a bit of journalism, not the best article. I don't know if you agree with me on that. I don't know. I kept waiting for like them to get to the article promised like, here's what they did. And I'm like, okay, where do they get to what they did?
It has
a lot of background. It's actually very good. To me, like the critical point in this article was when they stepped back and said, hey, we're going on like gut here. Let's get some data. And they went out and basically their impression of their own community was that this community is blighted and run down. And blight is a huge problem. It's bringing us down. We need to do something. What do we do? And then they went out and actually did a count, like how many places are actually blighted and where are they and what like geographically is going on. And the thing they found, it was actually a very small percentage of the homes have these problems, but because of how their space and because of how they impact people, it was a huge deal. It was like a kind of pervasive mindset that it kind of set in that, well, this is a community in decline. To me, this kind of picked up a little bit on the stuff that Paul Stewart in Oswego had been telling me for a long time, which I was kind of leery of until he kept beating it into my head. I kind of come from the CNU school, and I think that has some blinders at times where it's like, well, if you get the architecture right and you get the, you know, the building, the way it addresses the street right, like all these things will take care of themselves. And Paul will tell you, and I think this article here is kind of reinforcing that, is like, no, there's deeper things. And if you don't require kind of a base level of what I'll just call like social respect for neighbors, of landlords and of, you know, just people who own property, if you don't require them to, you know, keep the windows not boarded up, but, you know, keep them in repair, have a basic like level of yard maintenance where you're not allowing the weeds to get knee high and you're taking care of it. If you don't do these base things, it doesn't matter what else you do. There's going to be a kind of persistent level of blight that creeps into the mentality and the culture of the community, and the expectations will in a sense reinforce that decline.
Yeah. Well, the way that they did it in particular, I was kind of surprised because I realized I'd never talked to you about this, Chuck, that you were like, sure, why not? They, instead of taking the approach of that most cities take, which is, you know, you get a report that someone isn't taking care of their property. You send a city inspector out. They write a ticket and say, here's a fine. They instead went to all of these landlords and property owners around the community and said, basically, you have 30 days to actually do this stuff. And if you don't, then the city's going to come out and we're going to fix it for you. And you're going to have to pay us back, which, of course, is a risky strategy because, right. You know, you have to have the money to upfront pay these people's, you know, what it costs to fix this stuff and then to leverage the fines and the interest when they don't pay up immediately. But it seems like it really stimulated a lot of these property owners to actually just like, you know, say, okay, I'll mow the lawn, I'll do it. You know, I don't want you to have to charge me for that, whatever a city contractor is going to charge to mow a lawn. So I just found that kind of an interesting shift. What did you think about that piece of the article?
It's funny because I've actually seen that used in places. Here in Minnesota, it's very easy for a local government to put a lien on your property. And so that's actually a very common technique here. If you don't do something, they can just go do it and then charge you the cost. And if you don't pay it, it goes as a lien on your property. And so whenever there's a property transaction in the future, the city can recoup that cost. And that could get very high, you know, if you persistently don't do it. So the part about that I found interesting was the kind of, like you said, the de-emphasis of the fining. But I think also the recognition mm-hmm. that this was something where you had to get out and in a way like experience the neighborhood at that base level, right?
Yeah.
Once you were out there and once you interacted with people, they started to recognize that like, this is not a fine type of thing. Like fines are just going to engender a lot of animosity and right. they're really not going to solve the problem. A lot of people won't be motivated by the fines and, you know, fines have a whole like criminal aspect to them that now you've got court proceedings to go through and all that. The better way to do it, the way that was going to have the most effect for the time and energy you were spending on this was just to go fix it. Just go do it.
Right.
And get in the habit of having it be done and the expectation be that it be done. And then figure out like, how are we going to, you know, basically like what's the mechanism where we would recoup our money for that? I thought that was a kind of a mental switch that a lot of municipalities have a hard time making because they think of this only as a, you know, our only tool is to fine someone. And really cities have a lot more tools than that. And I think a lot more tools than that, that are, I think it's more compassionate to go and do it than it is to fine someone for not doing it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it also, you know, speaks to the idea that the city views your real estate as a home and it's part of a neighborhood as opposed to a financialized parcel that is up for exchange. Right. I couldn't help thinking about here in St. Louis and specifically on the north side of St. Louis, you know, there are a lot of private land bankers basically who, you know, have fine after fine after fine from the city just that they're sitting on. And it's a part of the cost of doing business. It's not going to prevent them from selling the property. They're never really going to have to pay that stuff. So they don't because they're viewing these parcels as, you know, an asset on a balance sheet, not a place where people actually live. So the idea that, you know, let's just go out and do it and then make it harder for this person, that actually sets up a better incentive system that I think was really smart. And I'd never heard of it before. I'm pleased to hear that other communities have it in place.
Yeah, totally agree. One of the things that I like latched on to in this article that I really like was this mayor, you know, and particularly about the mayor that he went out and walked the streets.
Yeah.
It says, you know, in the article here, right after he was elected, he took his own blight tour, visiting a neighborhood with a house that he said served as an open air drug market on and off for 40 years. He began knocking on doors and greeting residents. He talked to an elderly woman who pointed to the house and said, you know, bad people live there. And, you know, he's quoted as saying he walked off heartbroken, realizing this woman was, in a sense, a prisoner in her own city, because mm-hmm. no one was taking care of this, and they went out and took care of it. I think it's that, for me, the thing that was compelling about this article was the way that the city responded to the problem by orienting themselves to the neighborhood level, to the block level, to the people that were there, as opposed to what most cities do, which is, what is the grant we can get? What's the state or federal program that we can latch onto? Who's the developer that we can subsidize or you know, go in debt for, or, you know, get rid of our rules for, that they can come in and make some investment to push this off to the side or cover it up? This mayor and the city in general actually went out and said, we're going to get real on the block level and try to understand these problems from the perspective of the people we're serving. And I think that that's not sexy. That's not something you're going to win an American Planning Association award for. It's not something that's going to, you know, get you on the cover of Governing magazine or whatever it is. Uh-huh. But I'm really impressed with Fast Company by saying, this is an original concept. This is like bread and butter running a city. And there should be some, you know, some kudos here for a city that's willing to humble themselves in that way.
Right. What would you say to people who are listening to this, though, and saying, like, but Chuck, it doesn't scale, you know, like there's no way for the mayor of San Francisco to get out and take a blight tour on this level? Like, you know, what's the balance between efficiency and effectiveness here?
To me, at the local level, this does scale. I mean, this is the only thing that scales that actually gets at the problem. And in the end, I mean, we talk about this a lot, the trade-off between efficiency and stability. At the very block level, it's not about efficiency anymore. It's really not. When you focus on efficiency, you get, like in the words of Steve Mozon, a place that's not worth maintaining. You know, you get a place that doesn't respond to people's needs. Here's the important part, I think, that didn't come out in the story, but really goes back to what Paul in Oswego has said many times. And that is, when you have neighborhoods that have blight like this and neglect, and seemingly everyone in positions of authority that are tolerant of the decline and have their obsessions and their focuses in other places, what happens is that neighborhoods develops a confidence problem. And you have what Paul has called a bank run on confidence. The confidence as a metric just declines. Nobody cares. This neighborhood's not going in the right direction. This neighborhood's never going to go in the right direction. Anything I do to try to, you know, help is just going to be wasted time. And people feel, like this mayor described, trapped, a prisoner in their own place. What this neighborhood focus does is not only deal with the immediate blight, not only kind of effectively address the problem, but it starts to reverse this bank run of confidence. When you can go out and show real progress on a block level, and then if you can follow that up with real progress from a city level, going out and doing the city's part by mowing the boulevard, taking care of the parks, planting the trees, keeping the sidewalks from developing cracks, painting the crosswalks regularly. If you can do just the basic bread and butter things that a city should do, a streetlight goes out, you fix it and repair it. All of a sudden, what you're doing is not only your job, but you're taking all of that private energy off the sidelines and putting it back into play in that neighborhood. You're mobilizing a whole bunch of people who have put themselves on the sideline because they didn't have confidence. You're putting those people and their hopes and dreams and their energy and their vision for the future, you're putting all that back in play. And for a blighted community, for a community that's struggling, that's the most powerful part of this. That's the difference maker right there.
It's amazing. You know, I want to talk about another piece of Twitter criticism we got this week, which is that Strong Towns doesn't like anything, that all we are is against things. And I think stories like this is like, it typifies to me why, like, maybe we give people that impression, because, like, what we really love are projects like this, shifts in the way that we approach our neighborhoods on a fundamental level. Things that I will say are really hard to write an article about that's going to be flashy and exciting, and certainly right. don't make as many headlines as, you know, that like transformative new co-living project in the whatever town in California. It's pretty astounding, though, what a big difference this makes. And I hope that us taking a little time to just like give kudos here can people appreciate that, because it's really powerful stuff. It's like the most powerful stuff.
I agree. And I'm working through Chris Arnotti's book that came out last week. And he has this very powerful way of describing front row people and back row people. Front row people being people who essentially our society is set up to work for, professional tract. You go to college, you get a professional job, you go forth, and there's a place for you in society. And not to say that people in the front row don't struggle. A lot of them do. A lot of them, you know, are struggling to make ends meet. But they're doing so within a framework that is kind of set up to respond to their needs. And then he contrasts that with the back row people, you know, the people like the woman in this article where the mayor went and, you know, talked to her in her house. And she's like, look, this isn't working for me. And here's what's going on in my neighborhood. These are people who it's easy to overlook, easy to discount, and easy to, I'm going to use a very strong word, but I think kind of use sometimes in your rhetoric. A lot of the debate we got in this week on Twitter, I did, and Daniel a little bit in his article, had to do with people who were frustrated with NIMBYs, people opposing development using Strong Towns language. And I know the very projects that they were talking about were a lot of these kind of big tower kind of transformation things where we go from single family home neighborhoods to multi-story condo units in a very short period of time, that the kind of development that is very intense change, very abrupt change, a lot of dislocation, a lot of big money people and a lot of, you know, changing capital dynamics in a neighborhood. There's a lot of nuance there to that. And I definitely don't support the people that were using our work to oppose these projects. I think they were clearly wrong, and they are clearly not allies of ours. But the idea that, you know, we only have two choices, as Daniel would put it, either a fire hose or a garden hose trickle, is just wrong. I mean, there's got to be a broader palette than that. And I think when we get caught up in the, Strong Towns opposes everything because we do have serious questions about the fire hose approach, I think overlooks the fact that we have vastly more neighborhoods that need nurturing, need, to use the same analogy, need a little bit of water and a little bit of fertilizer and a little bit of love to get them to the next place where they can be successful. And I think a lot of times our front row policies just don't acknowledge that and don't have a way of dealing with that.
Yeah. Well, this one's for the back row people. I like that phrase. I'm going to use that. Yeah. Let's go to the down zone now. You mentioned one book you're reading. Chuck, is that what's kind of lighting up your world right now? What are you enjoying?
Yeah. The Chris Arnotti book has been fantastic. And he's going to come back on the podcast again. We chat on Twitter every now and then. And what a powerful book and a powerful story. I'm proud of him because he's getting the whole tour now. He was on like CNN and a couple other major media outlets, and his book is getting the attention it deserves. So that's great. I've also been digging into Jonah Goldberg's Suicide of the West. It's one of these books that a lot of people in my circles have been recommending to me. And I've heard Jonah Goldberg on a couple of podcasts, and I enjoyed his insights, and the book kind of read by the author has been very, very stimulating as well. It's very challenging in many ways. So I've been getting through that and liked it. And of course, Godzilla. We went to Godzilla this week, which was great.
Yeah, yeah. So the Chris Arnotti book is called Dignity. I don't think we said that, but the other two, yeah, yeah. I think we got them in there. I'm going to talk about, I did not go see Godzilla with the team. We always do a thing on retreat where you have a choice of two movies and I always end up in the least popular one, but I saw Rocket Man and I thought it was pretty great. Though I did feel a little left out when y'all were riffing on Godzilla as urban renewal mechanism. I thought that was pretty fun. yeah. But the thing I wanted to talk about in the Down Zone is a book I read that I just really liked, and it has nothing to do with strong towns. It is called Circe by Madeline Miller. It is a novelization of, if you remember back to your high school English classes, there is a character in Homer's Odyssey who is a witch who houses Odysseus on his journey home. And it is her story. And I usually don't really go in for this kind of thing. I'm a big nerd who studied ancient Greek. And
that's,
I'm like,
fascinating.
Yeah, but yeah. It's just like, was this delectable, super well-written, beautifully told, awesome audiobook. I will say the audiobook narrator deserves prizes. So Circe by Madeline Miller is my submission this week.
Wow. I'm gonna check that one out.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening to another episode of F-Zone. If you want to support the show, you can always do that in lots of ways. You can give us a rating on iTunes. Ideally, 5 stars would be very nice of you. You can support the Strong Towns movement at strongtowns.org/membership. You can get your next Down Zone read lined up by pre-ordering a little book called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity by Charles L. Marone Jr. Or you can just keep doing what you can to build a strong town, whether you're in Mobile or anywhere else. Thanks so much.
Take care.